राधमाधव कुंज बिहारी गोपी जन बहला गिरवारे धारी गोपी जन बाला गिरवारे धारी यशोदा नंदन व्रज जन रंजन यशोदा नंदन व्रज जन रंजन यमुना तीर वन छहरी यमुना तीर वन छहरी जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी जय ओम विष्णुपाद परमहंस परव्रजगोचर सुतेर सत श्री श्रीमद् डिवाइन ग्रेस एसी भक्तिवेदांत स्वामी महाराज श्रील प्रभुपाद की इस्कॉन फाउंडर चार्य श्रील प्रभुपाद की जय समवीर भक्तवृंद की जय गौर प्रेमानंद ऑल ग्लोरीज टू सिंबल डिवोटीज ऑल ग्लोरीज टू सिंबल डिवोटीज ऑल ग्लोरीज टू सिंबल डिवोटीज ऑल ग्लोरीज टू श्री गुरु एंड श्री गौरांगा जय प्रभुपाद नमः ओम विष्णुपादाय Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nitya Namane Namaste Sarasvati Gauravani Bhacharya Nirvishesha Srinivadi Paskitare Sitam. It's allowed to take it off, aren't you? Oh, them. Breathing a lot of carbon dioxide. Okay. I was just thinking before we began, this is such a wonderful month and you know, there's so many devotees. I haven't seen lines like that, you know, almost for a morning program since before COVID, you know. So it was just so nice to see so many devotees worshiping Radha Damodar and Radha Shama Sundar and all the deity. Anyway, it's a wonderful month. And of course, Chaturatma spoke about some of the glories of Kartik yesterday, so I won't go and repeat that. But I was just thinking, not only do we have this wonderful, wonderful pastime of Damodar offering the lamps for the whole month, but when we think of all the things, all the festivals that happen during this month, you know, we have Govardhan Puja. Of course, it's almost like, I don't know how to say, for us it's very special because Prabhupada's disappearance, it's not really part of the festive mood exactly, but that's of course in this month. And then so many wonderful things happen. I remember there's a whole chapter in Srimad Bhagavatam on Vrindavan in autumn, right? And how beautiful it is. That's during this time. Of course, I think now this time of year is pretty dry in Vrindavan. I think every time I've been there in October, November, it's been quite dry. I only had the good fortune once. I don't know why I went to India in July. You know, good choice, right? And so I went to Vrindavan just briefly. And it was just beautiful because it was the rainy season. It's kind of got a whole different sort of, you know, because I'm very limited by my physical senses rather than my spiritual ones, you know, I just saw Vrindavan in this beautiful light and thinking that's what it's like, you know, gives you a little glimpse of Kartik. And of course the Rasa dance happens during this month. Isn't it on the full moon night? The Sharat? I'm not, anyways, someone might know better. But so it's really just a beautiful month. And now, we kind of go in a little different direction here, talking about Maharaj Parikit and the age of Kali. So, here we go. I've got three verses today. Text, if I can find them, I think it's chapter 17, text 4, 5, and 6. So I think because of time, and why don't we just read through the Sanskrit and the English together, I guess, or I could just read English either way. What are we starting with? Four, okay. So, we can read together. Papriccha ratam aruda kartasvara parichchadam mega gambiraya vacha samaropita karmuka. Maharaj Prakrit, well equipped with arrows and bow, and seated on a gold embossed chariot, spoke to him, the Shudra, with a deep voice resounding like thunder. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. An administrative head or king like Maharaj Prakrit, with full majestic authority, well equipped with weapons to chastise miscreants, can challenge the agents of the age of Kali. Then only will it be possible to counteract this degraded age. And in the absence of strong executive heads, there is always disruption of tranquility. The elected show bottle executive head, as representative of a degraded public, cannot be equal with a strong king like Maharaj Prakrit. The dress or style of royal order does not count. It's one's actions that are counted. Text 5.
Kastvam machtranane loke baladamsya balanbali naradevo viveshena natavat karmanodvija.
Translation. Oh, who are you? You appear to be strong, and yet you dare kill, within my protection, those who are helpless. By your dress, you pose yourself to be a godly man, king, but by your deeds, you are opposing the principles of the twice-born Kshatriyas. Purport. The Brahmins, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas are called twice-born because for these higher classes of men, there is one birth by parental conjugation, and there is another birth of cultural rejuvenation by spiritual initiation from the bona fide acharya or spiritual masters. So a Kshatriya is also twice born like a Brahmin, and his duty is to give protection to the helpless. The Kshatriya king is considered to be the representative of God to give protection to the helpless and chastise the miscreants. Wherever there are anomalies in the routine work by the administrators, there is an incarnation of the Lord to reestablish the principles of a godly kingdom. In the age of Kali, the poor helpless animals, especially the cows, which are meant to receive all sorts of protection from administrative heads, are killed without restriction. Thus, the administrative heads under whose noses such things happen are representatives of God in name only. Such powerful administrators are rulers of the poor citizens by dress or office, but factually, they are worthless, lower class men without the cultural assets of the twice born.
Srila Prabhupada doesn't hold back, does he?
I love this. Twice more spiritually uncultured local or class men. Therefore, in the age of Kali, everyone is unhappy due to the maladministration of the state. The modern human society is not twice born by spiritual culture. Therefore, the people's government by the people who are not twice born must be a government of Kali in which everyone is unhappy. Okay, one more. Text 6. Sit up.
Yastvam Krishne Gate Dharam Saha Gandiva Danvana Shocho Sho Shochayan Rahasi Praharan Varamarhasi.
You rogue, do you dare beat an innocent cow because Lord Krishna and Arjuna, the carrier of the Gandiva bow, are out of sight? Since you are beating the innocent in a secluded place, you are considered a culprit and therefore deserve to be killed. Purport. In a civilization where God is conspicuously banished and there is no devotee warrior like Arjuna, the associates of the age of Kali take advantage of this lawless kingdom and arrange to kill innocent animals like the cow in secluded slaughterhouses. Such murders of animals stand to be condemned to death by the order of a pious king like Maharaj Prakrit. For a pious king, the culprit who kills an animal in a secluded place is punishable by the death penalty, exactly like a murderer who kills an innocent child in a secluded place. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Sambhadale Shimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nityanamani Namaste Saraswati and Gauravani Pacharane Nirvishesha Shunyavani Paskachandi Sitarane. I think I neglected. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Tamarandisha Gananjana Salakaya Chakshurimitamena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Vanchikopaturibhyascha Kripa Sindhu Vyebhacha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. Jai Prabhupada. So, we're talking a lot about the duties of the leaders and how they should be and how they've become corrupted. There are some interesting points in these three purports. Prabhupada talks about protection of cows, what's the twice-born class, and many ideas like this. But sort of the connecting idea between these three purports and verses is really about how Kali represents the breakdown in righteous leadership, the breakdown of spiritual leadership, and those who are actually degraded and unqualified will pose themselves, as Kali did, dressed as a king or dressed as a leader. So this is the beginning of degradation amongst the kings and leaders. Of course, we know Kali Yuga begins with the disappearance of Lord Krishna and continues for some years, 420,000 years. And King Parikshit is one of the last of the Rajarshis. He represents the saintly king, the devotee of Krishna. Actually, I was just reading Srimad Bhagavatam again in the I think it's in the 12th canto, because I was looking up some of the things about Kali Yuga, and apparently there are a number of kings that are mentioned for another several hundred years or 1,000 years that carried on in the first part of Kali Yuga. So while Kali Yuga was advancing, there was still actually a little bit of religiosity and some good leaders that are mentioned up to, I think the last mentioned is a King Nanda or something, about 1,000 years after Shukadeva Goswami was telling the story. So this is all prophesized. But what's also prophesized is the complete degradation in this age of Kali. And especially much blame must be apportioned to the leaders. Now the Vedic system was a monarchy, but it wasn't a monarchy like we know of Queen Elizabeth or different, you know, kings or rulers like that. But it was spiritually enlightened. That was really the point. And Prabhupada said it's this breakdown of spiritual enlightenment which is causing so many anomalies in this age. And Srimad Bhagavatam 2:27-22, Srila Prabhupada writes in his purport, the Kshatriyas are the ruling administrators of any part of the universe, either on this planet or on other planets, are factually the representatives of the almighty personality of Godhead. And they are meant to lead the subjects towards the path of God realization. Every state and its administrators, regardless of the nature of the administration, monarchy or democracy, oligarchy or dictatorship or autocracy, have the prime responsibility to lead the citizens toward God realization. This is essential for all human beings and is a duty of the father, spiritual master, and ultimately the state to take up the responsibility of leading the citizens towards that end. So the system, although it was based on monarchy, was one of mutual service, not exploitation, with a very specific goal of God realization, of bringing all the members of the society, all the different classes of people, to raise themselves to eventually become closer and closer to the ultimate goal of pure love of God, of Krishna. So as Kali Yuga progresses, that conception also becomes degraded, and in fact, it's totally lost. And this is all, of course, predicted in the Bhagavatam. You know, the 12th canto, the first three chapters, have some very nice descriptions, you know, that you can read those now, and you kind of go, yeah, check, 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 yep, they're all happening, exactly as the Bhagavatam predicts thousands of years ago. The Bhagavatam, a couple of the verses from, this is Bhumi talking, actually, about what's going to happen to the earth in chapter 3, of Canto 12, text 7 and 8. For the sake of conquering me, the earth, materialistic persons fight one another. Fathers oppose sons, brothers fight one another, because their hearts are bound to possessing political power. Political leaders challenge one another. All this land is mine. It's not yours, you fool. Thus they attack one another and die. In other words, causing so much havoc, so much disruption, so much pain and suffering. You know, there's enough. It always amazes me. You think there's enough suffering in the material world, right? That human beings don't have to create so much additional by, you know, killing each other, torturing each other. You have to know, this is Kali Yuga. This is a symptom. This is the way people are. They're our natures. And so today we see this corruption of monarchy. Prabhupada says, this is 4.12.10 purport, a king is not meant to simply realize taxes from the citizens and accumulate wealth to spend in sense gratification. World monarchy has failed ever since kings began to satisfy their personal senses with the taxes accumulated from the citizens. Of course, whether the system is monarchy or democracy, the same corruption is still going on. You know who the richest woman in England is? The Queen, of course. And, you know, in other words, where did all the wealth come from? I mean, you know, it's like from this, ultimately from the citizens, you know, that we have, you know, just, you know, incredible amounts of mass. I mean, I don't have anything against Queen Elizabeth, actually, you know, but it's just the point, the principle is there, you know, that accumulation of wealth with very little given back to the citizens. And what's important here is Prabhupada says it doesn't matter what type of system. Monarchy, democracy, oligarchy, I mean, they're all basically doing the same thing. So in Kali Yuga, most of the monarchies are corrupt. So the result was the rise of democratic ideas, because people think it's much better to elect their own corrupt rulers of their choice than have a corrupt ruler imposed upon them from outside. So anyway, the real corruption actually is because there's no Brahmins. The concept of service to God is lost because rulers no longer see themselves as servant, as did Maharaj Parikshit, a servant of the people. And they also don't see themselves as being accountable to the Brahminical class. And of course, the Brahminical class provided good counsel, good advice, which was all spiritually based. Of course, the Brahmin was supposedly a self-realized Vaishnava. Prabhupada has pointed this out many times, and of course, that has not been the case since Kali Yuga began. That's one of the unfortunate things. Another point is the actual Vedic political system is meritocracy. You had to be qualified. You couldn't just be born as the prince and then become the king. Now, that often happened because usually, you know, by one's qualities and one's personality and, you know, their basic propensities, they'd be born in that family to be able, because they would have those propensities, and they'd be trained. They'd be trained by the Brahmins, trained by the Kshatriyas from birth, how to properly execute those things. But if they were not qualified, they couldn't hold a position. And in fact, those who were very unqualified, who were actually almost demonic in their activities, were removed. We remember King Vaina. There was a very righteous Vaishnava king when he left his... Who was it? Who was Vaina's father? Anga? Okay, so when King Anga died, his son was Vaina. He naturally assumed the king. It turned out that he was just ruthless. He murdered people. He suppressed the Brahmins. He suppressed, you know, every possible sinful activity. So what was the only recourse the Brahmins had? They took him out. I mean, seriously, they killed him. They said by high-sounding words, by mantra. They killed King Vaina, and they installed, somehow turning his body or something, they installed Prithu Maharaj, who was, of course, one of the most absolutely highly qualified kings. In fact, he's considered to be a Shaktivesh avatar of Krishna, or an avatar of Krishna in Prithu. So, and of course, another example is Kamsa. Kamsa has basically had a reign of terror going against the Brahminical class and against the Vaishnavas and devotees. Can you imagine, you know, killing all your nieces and nephews and imprisoning your sister? You know, this is a, you know, total demon. So Krishna killed him personally. He was fortunate. Krishna killed him personally, you know, but for various reasons. But this is the idea that those in position of authority have a duty not to exploit, but to take care of their charges, both materially and spiritually. All those needs were really supposed to be fulfilled by the king or the ruler. I mean, look at the responsibility of like Arjuna, wonderful example of a Kshatriya ruler. And of course, Yudhishthira, he was the actual emperor, his brother, who was, of course, called Dharmaraj, completely saturated in knowledge of the Vedas, of religious principles. He was religion personified, of course, the son of Yamaraj. You know, so anyway, but Arjuna, almost equally qualified, and where was I going with this, with Arjuna? took great responsibility for the citizens under his charge, to the point where when a Brahmin came and said that what his sons had died, Arjuna took personal responsibility for that. I'll make sure that doesn't happen. In fact, you know, he travels throughout the universe to bring the sons back. I mean, this is almost, we couldn't even believe this today, that any ruler would possibly take any responsibility like that. But this is the way that it was done. And so, unfortunately, it's described that everyone is a Shudra, Kali Yuga. We don't have Kshatriyas, we don't have Brahmins, we don't even have Vaishyas. I mean, who's protecting the cows other than the devotees and very few people, right? So we don't even have qualified Vaishyas, whose job is to protect the cows and do agriculture and trade, etc. But we have throughout history, especially through the history of the Puranas, the Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavat Purana, so many histories of righteous kings, of qualified leaders, who were great devotees as well as great kings and rulers. And that's partly what made them, mostly what made them great rulers, was because they were great devotees. So I thought it was interesting, because when you think about Srimad Bhagavatam, this is like the summum bonum. This is the highest perfectional scripture that one can read. This is all about Krishna. Krishna is the center. We are getting the revelation of great saints and sages about Krishna and his activities. But it's interesting that so many of the activities they relate have to do with these kings, right? You have Pritumara, you have so many, Chichiketu, you've got Maharaj Parikshit, of course, you know. And so it's interesting that I would only assume, because this was the beginning of Kali Yuga, Shukadeva needed to make sure that he really covered this, you know, as far as what is the proper role of leaders and kings and like this. You know, I mean, he couldn't just talk about, you know, 10th canto pastimes. He had to really cover everything for the people going into Kali Yuga. And this recounting of so many of these leaders and great Rajarshis is for our benefit, for us to understand, to give example to us. Ramachandra, of course, was the perfect king when he appeared. When Krishna appeared as Ramachandra, he said no one suffered within his kingdom. In the verse from 1953 says, Lord Ramachandra, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, was the king of this world. All bodily and mental suffering, disease, old age, bereavement, lamentation, distress, fear, and fatigue were completely absent. Of course, that's the influence of the Personality of Godhead. But his kingdom is called Ramraj. And that's even that really resonates with people, particularly in India. In fact, it's something they always try to bring back. And of course, political parties like to say that, you know, that somehow they represent that idea of Ramraj, which of course they don't. But it's still revered by people that this is an ideal king. This is the standard, you know. Now, we were talking about King Prithu. In Bhagavatam 4.16.7, it says, this King Prithu will be very, very kind to all citizens. Even though a poor person may trample over the king's head by violating the rules and regulations, the king, out of his causeless mercy, will be forgetful and forgiving. As a protector of the world, he will be as tolerant as the earth itself. So this is a quality which we rarely see in modern politicians, do we, who often appear, you know, very arrogant and very kind of self-confident, full of themselves. Whereas Prithu was able to, as a warrior, defeat anybody, but yet he took this incredibly humble position. If anybody insulted him, or, you know, he would not take it personally. You know, so in other words, he just saw himself as a servant of the people, and it wasn't about his ego. So this is really important. Also, another great example was in the story of Jatabharat, Rat Rahugana. Another story of a great king who needed a little spiritual instruction from Jatabharat, you know, who had, of course, appeared as a deaf, dumb, mute person who they thought had lower intelligence. Of course, he was a great self-realized soul. Bart Maharaj became the deer, then became Jed Barrett. So it says in 512.8, actually, the supreme proprietor of everything is Lord Vishnu. This is Jed Barrett speaking. He is the maintainer of everyone. The king, the father, and the guardian are simply representatives of Lord Vishnu, empowered by him to look after the management and maintain things. It's therefore the duty of the head of the state to maintain the general populace in such a way that people will ultimately know the goal of life. So, of course, Rahugana, being actually a great soul himself, was a little bit proud of his position as a king. And Jed Barrett, through strong preaching, Rahugana was able to accept that here's a great, great soul giving the instruction. And of course, he made great changes himself, became a pure devotee. So the duty of all leaders is to help their dependents towards devotional service. That's the goal. That's the goal of life, as been stated here. And it's stated by Lord Vrishabhadeva that the role of any leader is to deliver dependents from repeated birth and death. And if one cannot, one should never become a spiritual master, a father, a husband, a mother, or a worshipful demigod. So this idea of leadership, helping people to get out of the condition of birth and death, go back to Godhead, as the duty of all leaders, this is quite a task that's been given to all of us, really. I was thinking about this, if that's the purpose of the leaders, to liberate the all of their dependents from birth and death. Can you imagine having a political a debate? And one of them said, I can best liberate everybody. I'm going to institute Varnashram and Prasadam distribution. He says, well, yeah, but I've got a big Harinam program. I'm going to liberate everybody in that way. So, wouldn't that be wonderful if we lived to see that? We won't. But at any rate, that's the real issue. That should be the real issue. How do we best help people of birth and death? So it's not just the duty of the king, as Lord Vrishabhadeva says. Anyone in position of authority, if we have any immediate authority, if we have children, if we're a teacher and we have students, we have devotees under our care or shelter, or if we're any kind of administrator or manager, we have this great duty to those who are under us to help them in their Krishna consciousness with their spiritual life. Of course, they can also help us. So this is what's needed, that everybody takes this responsibility very seriously. And there's really two kinds of authority. There's two kinds of dependents. One of those immediate ones we might have, our family members or whatever. But there's also, all devotees have a natural authority. You have authority. Why? Because you're representatives of Krishna. You're representatives of your guru. Right? We all are. And that's quite a position when you think about it, compared to most of the population. We have this, not to get puffed up about it, but we do actually have knowledge of the absolute truth. So we have an obligation to, by that authority of our guru who has empowered us to some degree, to whatever degree that we accept that, to give this knowledge to others. So if you're a disciple, a grand disciple, or whatever, you're actually an authority on Vedic knowledge, your authority on Krishna consciousness. So we need to represent Prabhupada and Krishna in that way and help Prabhupada's desire of spreading Krishna consciousness all over the world on behalf of his guru and Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So the service attitude, of course, does not mean we don't perform duties. Leaders often must act with decisiveness. They have to take strong action. We just see the example right now. Pariket Maharaj immediately takes up his sword and is ready to kill Kali. Very strong action. He's not saying, are you being aggressive like this because of some trauma you've experienced? Or, can we talk about, and I probably would because I'm a counselor, But Maharaj Pariket, no, I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't. I would go along with the Maharaj Pariket administration of justice, I think. But Prithu, before he, in the beginning, because the earth was withholding due to the sinful activity of the people, he was going to kill the earth. He was going to kill the presiding goddess, deity of Bhumi. Of course, she explained to him, no, it's not my fault. You know, it's Vena, you know, and withholding sacrifice. So he understood that, and of course he didn't. But the point is that a real Kshatriya ruler would take strong action when needed. And even we see, even with Brahmins or people who are not, now, you know, Prabhupada was such an interesting personality. I mean, even aside from the fact that he's Jagat Guru, you know, a pure devotee, you know, self-realized soul, we can say all those things, but he was also a fantastic manager. He was a great leader. He knew how to inspire people. He knew how to, you know, how to organize a worldwide movement. I mean, we were always amazed that, you know, we were all young kids, you know, practically. It seemed like Prabhupada knew everything, right? I mean, those of you might remember. I mean, it's like he knew everything. You know, he showed the devotees how to do accounting. You know, he knew about if people were sick, he had knew some medicine to give. It seemed like he knew everything. You know, it's just he had this curiosity, you know, about knowledge. He was, you know, he totally knew the scriptures, the verses, you know, and all spiritual knowledge. And of course, he was very, very wonderful and kind to us, but sometimes Prabhupada had to chastise us or correct us. The spiritual master has to correct the disciples out of love. So similarly, the leader of the country needs to correct those who are doing wrong. It's a natural thing. A parent corrects the child, sometimes even punishes the child for their benefit. It's out of love, right? It's not to hurt them or that you'll get something out of it. Say, I need to teach this child, so he tell me he can't do that, you know, or must do this. So the key element is that actions must be done from a service perspective, and ultimately, not from self-interest, but our service to Guru, to Krishna. You know, and even on the more, as we do our service in this material world, we have service to our family, to our community, to the ISKCON society, to the greater public. You know, we have these obligations. You know, and if we have that mood of service, I'm serving my spiritual master, I'm serving Radha Krishna by doing this, then we're rightly situated. So sometimes we need to be very loving in our service and very understanding. Sometimes we need to correct or challenge if that's our service and that's the appropriate thing for us to do. So that's it, for effectiveness of leadership, there must be certain qualities and character. The management skills were usually already there with the Kshatriya kings, you know, because they were born into it, they were trained into it. But they had a spiritual character of devotional practice. And they had to have that ability to bring out spiritual character in others, a vision to see into others' spiritual life. You know, Srila Prabhupada was such a great example of this. So many devotees said, it seemed like Prabhupada just knew me exactly. He knew what I needed to hear. He knew how to give that advice or say the right thing at the right time. It made huge impact in people's lives. Many of us who had about 3 sentences of conversation with Srila Prabhupada during his manifest presence, you know, we remember those 3 sentences, you know, clearly, you know, 30 years later. They form, you know, our life, you know, or a letter we got from Srila Prabhupada. These are the words, you know, that motivate us and we feel as our life and soul, the instructions of our spiritual master. But the idea is the leader sees the bigger picture. And also, not only transmitting spiritual character, but establishing spiritual culture. Prabhupada used that word in the first purport today about a culture of Krishna consciousness. And this establishment of culture has to do with establishing religious principles, perhaps varnashrams, supporting the cows, Brahminical culture and standards are very important. And Srila Prabhupada wanted to do this. I mean, he once said book distribution and starting temples was half of his work, and establishing culture, and also varnashram, I think he said in that same time, was the other half of his work. So a spiritual culture develops out of spiritual practice, and a spiritual practice develops out of spiritual philosophy. So Prabhupada gave us the philosophy, he gave us the practice based upon Rupa Goswami and all the acharyas, and then he wanted us to create a culture. This was interesting in the Quest for Enlightenment little book Prabhupada wrote. He said, in this Krishna consciousness movement, we are giving people a chance to understand the problems of life and how to solve them. It is not a sectarian movement or a so-called religious movement. It is not a religion. It's an educational and cultural movement. That's interesting. So this was very important, this broader concept of how we bring in the whole society, the whole culture, into a culture of Krishna consciousness. So obviously Prabhupada created the ISKCON society. In his seven purposes of ISKCON, he mentioned things like a place to bring the devotees together, to help one another, to sustain the devotional life of the devotees. So we have, in Vedic society, we have Varnashram as a structure, but the quality is based on bhakti. The real quality of Vaishnava culture is bhakti, is love and devotion. And love and devotion centered towards the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that must be the principle that everything's based upon. And that is what we saw in the great kings, and we see how that is now becoming eroded very quickly by Kali. Okay, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. It's actually time for class to end, but maybe there's a question or two. Or not. Adiday Prabhu.
I was just going to mention that I see a little bit of that, a little glimmer of that Kshatriya spirit in Tulsi Gabbard.
In what?
Tulsi Gabbard.
Oh, yeah, that's
she
true.
She has a little bit of that, that Shakti. You
know? Yeah, yeah.
And also, I know Prabhupada at one point talked to us about cultural weapons. He used that term.
Didn't he also say, didn't he use the term cultural conquest?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's definitely a part of our spreading Krishna consciousness.
Right. Yeah, and that's why Prabhupada always wanted things like Vedic Museum, right? I mean, seriously. I mean, these were all that's part of all the cultural elements that go along with Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada wanted the books, he wanted the preaching, wanted temples, but he wanted all of this, all the culture. He wanted art, he wanted, you know, the dioramas, he wanted music, he wanted everything, drama. You know, it's all there. The things that, you know, now I don't think we've established it very well, you know, with the full culture of Vaishnavism, but, you know, we're getting there more and more. And I think we see that the more we do, the more we thrive, and the more people feel, you know, happy about Krishna consciousness. Okay, thank you. Anything else? Whoa.
So, one might wonder why it is that Anga had such a demoniac son. And he learned that.
I don't know what's wrong with it. It's usually the battery's out, isn't it? Or is it or she, where you're sitting?
I mean, he learned that his wife, I believe it was a daughter of Sankarsana.
I'm sorry, who's what?
Anga. That he had such a demonic son as Bane, because he was a great, great king, a great soul, very devoted to Krishna and all. But in the purport, it explains that Anga also, he tried everything in Bane. He tried, you know, positive reinforcement, and he tried punishing, and just nothing worked, so finally he just left, you know, he just left home. He couldn't control him at all. And Prabhupada says that Krishna arranged it specifically for King Anga, so he would surrender to Krishna. Huh. So I thought that was really interesting, because sometimes, you know, things happen and they seem like, why? But Krishna's so kind to his devotee that he manufactures a way, you know, for them to come back to God. It's not necessarily karma. In fact, there's a lot of places in Bhagavatam where it's definitely not.
He's always devising ways to bring us closer to him. Sometimes those ways may seem a little harsh almost, or like, you know, they cause a little difficulty, pain, or some stress, or, you know, but we have to have that faith. And just and like that example, you know, King Dana is a very pious king, you know, devotee, and he has this horrible, what do you call him, the bad seed, you know, this, you know, Vena, you know, the worst. And it caused him getting so frustrated because, you know, that you said, like you say, he renounced, left home, and became a great devotee. So Krishna has many things going on at once. Mm-hmm. And he also is setting the stage for Prita Maharaj to incarnate, you know, and so many things are accomplished. That was an interesting point you raised. I was just reading the other day, I forget where it was, that, it was about Krishna appearing before the devotee. And it said that for the sadhaka, us, you know, the people on the path, Krishna often will withhold appearing, you know, to make us more eager. In other words, he could appear right before us, but he wants us to become more pure, more eager, more, you know, and then it's kind of like the whole thing with, you know, Viparlamba and Sambhoga, the separation, the meeting, that, you know, we become more and more eager for Krishna, and then we get a little glimpse of Krishna, you know, and it's just, it's so satisfying to the heart, you know.
Yeah. He deserved that.
Yeah.
There's a special word for it. I don't know if I'll get it right. It's something like Sandarshitatma, you know? That,
yeah.
I thought that was so amazing that Krishna gave him spiritual eyes so he was able to see him.
Yeah. Everything comes by the mercy of Krishna ultimately, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's like we can do nothing without Krishna's help. And that's another thing. The devotee feels himself always under the, you know, influence of Krishna, always under the protection of Krishna, too. Anything else? Yeah.
You give an example of Maharaj Prithu, that he was threatening the earth and, you know, she didn't comply. I've noticed several examples where similar thing happened, like Lord Ram when he was, you know, he was meditating on the sea to get, you know, to get the ocean to comply. Then when he was praying to meditating on Lord Shiva, he didn't comply. When Lord Balaram called on the Yamuna, things like, and there are many demigods that when called upon, they won't comply unless they're being threatened.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if that's a stubbornness that filtered through into Kali Yuga, where we are all having this nature that many times, unless we're being threatened or, you know, again, we don't comply.
Yeah.
Wonder if you can say something on that.
How there's reaction, you mean, when there's non-compliance?
Yeah,
we see the earth withholds, and there's reactions. Prabhupada gave the example that he said because of all the cow killing, that's the karma that creates all the wars that we have. Yeah, so there's always, if we're not serving Krishna personally or collectively as a society, you know, there are these, and I mean, you look at now of all the climatic things, and, you know, it seems like isn't there constantly an earthquake or a hurricane or something killing thousands of people or, you know, volcanoes? So, yeah, I mean, it's there. We see it today. See, I just realized this has been a great discussion, and I'm supposed to be on a conference call in 5 minutes. So, Hare Krishna. I'll go to the show.